Welcome to the Risk and Repeat podcast, episode number 174. I'm Rob Wright, Security News Director at TechTarget, and this week I'm joined by a special guest, Carla Runcato, my colleague at Enterprise Strategy Group. Carla is a senior analyst at ESG, which is now part of the TechTarget family, and she is going to talk about her experiences from RSA Conference 2021, specifically around the startups featured at the Innovation Sandbox competition. So last episode, Alex Galafi and I discussed some of our big takeaways from the conference regarding the sessions and keynotes that touched on a variety of things like supply chain threats and election security. And in this episode, we wanted to dig into the technology trends and vendors a bit more. So let's listen to Carla's takeaways from this year's show.
Carla, thanks for joining us. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me. I'm Carla Runcato. I'm a senior industry analyst at the Enterprise Strategy Group. I cover identity and access management, open identity standards, data security, privacy, and zero trust initiatives.
And so you have been at Enterprise Strategy Group for about how long now?
Just 3 months. I took a little bit of a security hiatus. In my background, I have worked in the industry quite a long time, but more recently, I was working in a accelerator program, helping to fund SaaS startups. And then a little later, started doing M&A. So I was making acquisitions as part of Cognizant's data and analytics and AI practice. But before that, I worked at those big companies like Microsoft and McAfee and Intel in the security field.
So you got a good feel for the industry. That's good.
Yeah, pretty broad, most would say.
Yes. So you got a chance at RSA Conference, virtual RSA Conference this year.
Indeed.
To sort of take in some of the Innovation Sandbox competition. I spoke with the CEO of Apiro the other day, which won the competition, was named the most innovative startup at this year's competition. But I wanted to get your take because I don't know all of the companies that were in the competition this year. And I think there were a few notable ones that you can probably discuss here. So what were some of your takeaways from the competition this year?
Yeah, for sure. So as an analyst, I had the benefit of getting a couple of previews with some of these of the top 10, but I also participated in the live event as well. So overall, I was really impressed with the Innovation Sandbox contest this year. It really did take me back to being an advisor in those launchpad sort of pitch days. I can imagine the pressure that everyone was under to get those 3-minute pitches just so tight. And so for me, that was a highlight of the event. Like I mentioned earlier, I hadn't been at an RSA conference in a while. And since this one was entirely virtual, I felt like this was a really fun, you know, experience. And what I also liked about it was the fact that after those 3-minute pitches, they were followed up by some pretty tough questions from those judges. Mm. I heard from a couple of the participants that Paul was particularly tough, you know, on his questions. And of course, he is a security researcher and pretty famous for that. So yes. it was kind of funny. I asked him, like, who was the toughest? And everyone basically said, Paul asked the hardest questions for the most part. And that kind of is in line with expectations. So with that as a backdrop, I actually felt like those finalists that we're going to talk about today really did demonstrate in their respective fields. But again, to make that top 10 means everyone's a winner if you really think about it. So let's get started with one example. So one of my favorite pitches was by Satori. They're defining a new category called data SecOps. And it was quite fun to watch Hugh Thompson, who's the committee chair. He goes, a new category. Like, he's so enthusiastic when he's kicking it off. And that was a really interesting conversation I had with Satori. Was we were discussing whether they could really position themselves as a data SecOps, and we're like, yeah, do it. And for those people who aren't familiar with why it would be called data SecOps, I'm happy to sort of elaborate more if that would be helpful.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, great. So as I mentioned, I've been in that data analytics and AI space prior. So it's about a $300 billion business. And I think people sometimes don't realize how large that data business is and how much larger the data security business will become over time. So, you know, maybe a little later, we'll talk about what the future looks like in that space.
Sure.
So if you think about these segments emerging in that data and analytics space, you have data ops and you have ML ops. They're both functions and processes, but there's also technology there to support those functional areas. And so it's natural to introduce this concept of data SecOps into that environment. And it's really tied to business transformation projects. It's not tied so much to security posture, maybe, or security modernization. If you know, coming from a global GSI, a big systems integrator, we were doing lots and lots of data modernization projects as part of digital transformation journey. It's not just migration to the cloud, but it's actually moving all your analytical workloads to the cloud as well. So you can get all that real-time streaming data, just-in-time analytical, you know, changes you can be making across, it doesn't matter, e-commerce, you name it, all sorts of business and operational reasons. And so what makes this kind of interesting is that if you look at something like Snowflake last year, they were one of the largest IPO stories, maybe of the year. It was pretty tremendous. And what Satori does is focus on those pipelines, the algorithms, the jobs of data engineers and data scientists to help them reduce the risks associated with sensitive data. And they also ensure compliance in the use and reuse of that data. And in that way, that makes Satori very different because we are not talking about the security organization here in terms of the personas that they're concerned with protecting and ensuring that compliance with. And that's going to take a bit of a pivot, I think, for the industry to start thinking more broadly about their personas, who their target personas are in data security in particular.
Data SecOps, I'm going to have to remember that.
Exactly. You know, I haven't heard anyone, you know, say it yet. So Satori might be the first, but for me, it was a natural connection point to data ops and ML ops and that there'd be a data SecOps.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the other pitch that I thought was really great, and clearly the judges thought so too, was Strata Identity. So Strata came in second place. They have a platform called Mavericks, and what it focuses on is multi-cloud hybrid identity orchestration. And that's just a fancy way of saying any cloud, not one cloud, any cloud you want to be on. Also this mixed mode environment where you may have on-premises as well as cloud. Right. And again, multi-cloud. That's different than cloud identity. So it's worth noting. And what makes what Strata's doing interesting, and I think that's what got Shlomo kind of excited. He sat forward in this session when he heard the pitch given here by Eric. They take the difficult and costly effort out of rewriting apps that use siloed approaches. So there's a lot of silo identity systems still that exist out there. And there's a lot of legacy protocols that predate cloud, frankly. And they're also behind these aging single sign-on brokers, these SSO brokers that are end of life as well. So there's a whole bunch of things happening to organizations in the context of the pandemic, but also in the context of the life cycle of technology that's kind of coming to bear. And in really, really large enterprises around the world, they have hundreds, if not thousands, of custom applications. And I think also sometimes people forget that if you have a 50-year-old company and an 80-year-old company, you really have old apps. Like, they're really old. And so modernizing these apps one app at a time is not practical, achievable, cost-effective, and it might not even be advisable in many cases. But still, those apps perform a function that the company has needed for some amount of time, and they still exist for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And certainly this past year has taught us that remote access to these apps is likely to remain a priority even after the acute pain of COVID-19 on business operations has subsided. So that's where Strata really comes in. They make that application migration in bulk. So think about in bulk. If you have hundreds and hundreds of applications and they have all different types of identity schemes associated to them with different users and names, and it's difficult to figure out, you know, if that user is even part of another system. I mean, it's a really messy proposition.
Yeah.
They can do this in bulk in an automated way. And and they actually named one of their customers in their session Kroger, and there's many Krogers out there as an example. But this really gives those applications a little bit more life. It gives organizations a little more time, and it certainly gives them the ability to focus on their app modernization assessment programs. So prioritizing which ones they do want to modernize and rewrite and move permanently, or ones they just want to containerize and leave as they are, but externalize the access decisions, the authorization decisions most specifically. So that's the orchestration part of this. So hopefully that makes sense.
Because
orchestration piece is sort of sometimes lost on folks if they're not as familiar with like what orchestration is in the sort of big picture of things. It has one meaning often, like Kubernetes.
Yeah. So no, that's a great point. And then so the last pitch was the big winner.
The big winner, Apiro. Yeah.
So tell me about what your take on them. I know a little bit about the company, having talked with their CEO the other day, following their win and getting a sense of what how their platform works and what they're looking for in terms of the analyzing software and looking for, they talk about risky change material or about material change rather, sort of things that are done to code that sort of lead to compliance issues and vulnerabilities, sort of the changes, the decisions that are made in the background, I guess, that sometimes maybe we don't pay attention to, I guess. Maybe that's a good way to describe their...
I'll say this, like having, again, when you're building a bunch of SaaS apps, whether you're doing it from a venture perspective, as we were in a launchpad scenario, or whether you're building them because you're a software engineering shop, and so you build lots of applications on behalf of clients. Accenture does this, lots of big outsourcers do it, or you're an actual product vendor. This is an area that hasn't really been explored enough. We have the software-defined life cycle with a security aspect on it, but this is actually productizing that in many ways is how I describe it. So that, rightfully so, Apiro was the winner. I think everyone recognized they were addressing a gap in the market that has been there a really long time. So that was a definite, it should have been so obvious to all of us. Like none of us, even within my ESG peer group, would have predicted it. I think we thought, oh, it might go to Wiz, it might go to someone else. But it was such a pleasant surprise. And I have to give a shout out to my ESG colleague, Dave Gruber. He's been working with Apiro since before this nomination and win. So he has been helping them along the way with their go-to-market. So, props to him. So here's what makes Apiro unique again. Like we've talked a little bit about it, and they really got that tight pitch, that design to code to cloud. He said it three times and it kind of sticks in your head. And he, if you're familiar with test-driven design principles, it's a sort of the notion that there's like one tester to every 50 developer ratio. Yeah. And so you try to move test into the development process so that each developer is testing their bits of their code. And that way you can get those packages, staged appropriately and through the pipeline a little faster. So this is sort of the concept of I think he mentioned on the pitch, something like 1 to 150 or something from a security architect perspective. And I can tell you, I felt this pain because it bottlenecks there. It's not security's fault that it bottlenecks there. There really wasn't something further upstream to try to get that security testing done earlier in the development process. And so again, that's a security-driven design concept, just like test-driven design. And how did we not do this sooner is what I think about. And so that's what makes Apiro really compelling, is it's just as much for security vendors as it is for application modernization projects, as it is for large soft engineering firms, as it is for individual product development groups. So like it really applies to all application teams. And I'd say that really Apiro's timing could not have come at a better time in the market for all of us, but also I expect to see great results coming out of them from RSA, the halo effect, of course.
Sure.
And I would not be surprised at all if a number of parties are aggressively pursuing acquisition. I would imagine that we will not see them an independent too much longer, unless the VCs have something to say about that.
Yeah, maybe. You never know.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. So what, you know, from outside of the competition and seeing what those startups are doing, I guess your, what were your overall impressions of this show in terms of, I guess, things that stood out or themes maybe, or what you heard from organizations that you were talking to? Anything in particular stand out?
Yeah, a couple of things in particular. We all found the session on the global threat brief, the hacks and adversaries unveiled with, you know, FireEye and the Silverado folks. It truly felt like an intelligence briefing,
the entire
style of it, right? Like we all felt like we were getting an inside window of what it might be like to get an intelligence briefing on a regular basis. And, you know, it really did focus on those threat actor activities in those nation states. And the calling it out over and over again, North Korea, Russia, China, Iran, just repeatedly hearing it was like, wow, that made, again, it made it feel very much like a real briefing in that sense. And coincidentally, this was pre-recorded before the Colonial Pipeline ransomware. So we can only imagine how they might have changed the tone a little bit on that one and talked a little bit more about it. So that was one of the things we all detected was, and this is even before that happened.
Right.
So it was definitely ominous, and there was a lot of foreshadowing, for example, the upcoming Summer Olympic Games. I don't think any of us really think about the Olympic Games in a cybersecurity perspective, or at least I certainly didn't. I was thinking more about how gymnastics was going to go.
Yeah, right.
And so now I'm going to be thinking about the games a little differently. You know, they really kind of said, we expect a public demonstration. We expect a cyber incident.
Yeah, it's incredible. And, it's like you're chalking this into your calendar at this point. Like something is going to happen. I'm with you. I was pretty sort of, not shocked, but surprised, I guess, by that.
It was just the foreshadowing. It was it felt doomsday-ish. And, you know, there was this other point in the replay, I'm sure you heard it too, at about 24 minutes into the briefing, you can hear a child scream. And frankly, the session made us all want to scream by that point.
Yeah.
So it was kind of funny, but it was also kind of really appropriate at that moment.
Yeah, I sympathize. I sometimes my kids will interrupt that. They're not here today, so they can't interrupt this podcast. But sometimes, you know, just a random screech or yell or whatever.
Yeah. Usually at my house, it's barking dogs. So, but this morning it was actually a car alarm that went off for 10 minutes.
So yeah, break up the monotony and give you something different to listen to.
Yeah,
I guess looking ahead then, as RSA, what do you think, you know, M&A trends, investments, where do you think the market is going? We heard so much sort of leading up to RSA about things like, zero trust networks, zero trust models and zero trust access and just sort of, you know, revamping identity and access management as a whole. As you know, following the shift to remote work, but I guess where do you think things are going based on what you saw at RSA?
Even beyond RSA, I'm seeing a couple of things. Identity startups are getting funding, not nearly as much funding as traditional cybersecurity companies, but it's a positive indication that there are a number of investment firms out there willing to make investments into identity. Certainly, if you see something like Strata, they are serial entrepreneurs, and also they had raised about $11 million recently. So that's a positive sign. I expect to see that continue through 2021. Again, not the big $100 million investments yet, but certainly some are tipping into the $50 and $60 million mark in terms of, you know, getting to Series C type things. And a lot of this is in support of zero trust, of course, as we sort of rethink sort of decoupling identity from these centralized systems. And then the other thing I'm really observing, and there'll be more to come, and it'll be good for us to have a follow-up on, there's a number of vendors, incumbents in the market launching new platforms this year. So I'm excited because there's another couple of conferences coming up next, like Identiverse. And then of course we have Black Hat. So I expect to see a bunch of announcements, and you and I will both, you know, get that news together on different identity platforms. So these will be things taking advantage of things like least privilege and trying to really solidify least privilege as something that you can actually do, not just the principle of it, but the normalizing it and operationalizing it. So I think we'll see that. And I'd be pretty interested next year. I know they've moved RSA up to February, but I'd be pretty interested, or I'm predicting there'll be a least privilege themed contestant next year where it'll be all about least privilege. I'm predicting that. Yeah.
Nice. Well, I'm definitely looking forward to more platforms from some of the incumbent vendors or more offerings, because it does feel like, and I totally get this, it's been a little quiet over the last year during the pandemic. I can totally understand a lot of companies probably wanting to put off some of their big announcements or sort of take a little bit more time to refine some of their tech or their pitches or their models or whatever.
Yeah. There was a pause for sure.
There was definitely a pause. Yeah.
And yeah.
It's good. It's good to hear that, you know, maybe that's going to change.
Yeah, I think it will. And I also think that everyone learned a lot last year. Mm-hmm. You know, our behaviors broke models. The things we did broke models. So yep. I really think it made people go back and rethink some things about how they've been conducting business, not just organizations, but vendors. I think vendors are thinking differently about how they've been conducting business. Mm-hmm. I think it really pushed into the forefront that that operating model is going to change going forward for these organizations, which means their operating models also have to change. And that might be good for everybody, even if we had to learn it in a hard way.
Yeah. So a positive from the tough times.
Exactly.
There you go.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It kind of makes you take a step back. And I can even tell more consultative kind of advisory questions are coming up before, you know, really going too far forward in we know what we want to do. We're going to take a step back and make sure what we're doing is the right thing for our business.
Yeah.
Like you're getting just a little bit more of that introspection happening. And I think it's smart. I think it's a smart use of time and resources to do a little pivot or a little reset before you kind of go back into that hyper growth mode again.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Optimism. I like it.
I'm typically a very optimistic person, except for that one global threat brief. That one just grounded me in sadness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
Well, Carla, thank you so much for the time and the insight here. This was great. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Rob. I really appreciate it. I look forward to next time.